This is Functional Medicine Update for August 2005, Volume 25, Number 8. This month, our subject area will be stress and functional neurology. Our reports will include a review of the 12th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, also aspects of neurological function, including the relationship of gluten to dementia and immune response to Th2. We will discuss emotional stress and the Th1-Th2 balance, chronic stress's effect on vascular function, and plasma homocysteine and endothelial function. Our interview this month is with Dr. David Perlmutter discussing functional neurology. We will conclude this issue with a report on Gulf War syndrome. Now here's Dr. Jeffrey Bland with the August 2005 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
I think it would be noteworthy for us to spend this issue of Functional Medicine Update revisiting and focusing on some of the topics that were so beautifully and eloquently described at the 12th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, The Immune System Under Siege, New Clinical Approaches to Immunological Imbalances in the 21st Century. There were so many pearls dropped that one could easily trip over them on the floor. It was just one of those experiences in Palm Springs that was truly magic for those who attended, and I'd like to capture a couple of those thoughts for those of you who didn't have the fortune to be there, and those of you that were, maybe this will be a reminder of some of the high points and the clinical takeaways. As you recall, we started off the plenary sessions with an eloquent presentation by Dr. Esther Sternberg, director of the Integrative Neural Immune Program at the National Institutes of Mental Health. The whole theme of this particular presentation was, does stress make you sick? And I think she did a very nice job in outlining a tremendous body of recent information related to the neuroendocrine immune system. And in fact, it followed very nicely from the pre-course discussion by Dr. Ilya Alenkov, who had also been at the National Institutes of Mental Health, in which he had already described some of the remarkable relationships between the outside and inside world and the signaling process through the neuroendocrine immune system that modulates function across many organ systems and gives rise to conditions as disparate as depression or inflammatory bowel disease or multiple sclerosis or even coronary artery disease and cancer. That concept of the stress connection to illness, which obviously was pioneered by Hans Selye some 40 years ago, got the theme of the symposium to focus on broad-based mechanisms of dealing with complex chronic diseases of the immunological system. And of course, we would be remiss if we didn't at least acknowledge that in the spring of 2005, a major new document was published out of the Institute of Medicine of our national academies. This was entitled Complementary and Alternative Medicine in the United States, the Committee on the Use of Complementary and Alternative Medicine by the American Public, from the Board on Health Promotion and Disease Prevention. This monograph, which is now available for purchase from the Library of Congress and the Institute of Medicine, is a manifesto, I believe, for what is happening in the changing environment of healthcare today. I urge you getting a hold of this book and reading it because I think it has a tremendous insight as it pertains to the resistance of acceptance to some of these concepts that were described at our symposium that seems so self-evident to those who have been in this field for some time, but for others who may be outside the field seem still as complementary or alternative, meaning scientifically unproven. I think Dr. Sternberg helped us very much to understand why the acceptance of some of these ideas is so complex and that they cut across disciplinary boundaries and being easily compartmentalized into silos. And in fact, the book Complementary and Alternative Medicine in the United States once again demonstrates that complexity that is required to understand how one cuts across disciplines of organ system thinking. The book goes through a number of very interesting concepts that pertain to the acceptance and rising popularity of CAM, or Complementary Alternative Medicine, in the United States. Certainly, one of the things that we recognize is that about $27 billion a year are spent on CAM therapies. 42% of Americans report that they have used at least one CAM therapy in the previous year, and less than 40% of these individuals tell their doctors because they feel that maybe that's something that their medical doctors really wouldn't understand, so it's not useful information. There were 629 million visits made to CAM providers and 386 million to primary care doctors, suggesting that there are almost twice the number of visits to CAM providers as there are to primary care providers in the United States each year. As Dr. Stephen Strauss, the director of the NIH's National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, recently said about the report, he said, "This is an achievement that elevates the discussion of complementary alternative medicine beyond the advocacy and skepticism that has long been hampered into being looked at in a more scientific light and having a greater degree of testable hypotheses." He goes on to say, "It will further the scientific investigation of this field, increasing its legitimacy as a research area, and ultimately improve public health," end quote from Dr. Strauss. I think that we're witnessing this change in the paradigm, the changing of the guard, the transition to a healthcare system that better integrates techniques and strategies that will be directed towards the chronically ill patient, rather than focusing primarily on the application of resources for the management of acute disease at the absence of understanding how to set up a chronic disease management system that will undoubtedly draw from the replicable components of the complementary and alternative medical tradition. And I think it's that theme that was certainly borne out through the discussions that occurred at our symposium, because at the symposium, what we saw each investigator doing was outlining the basic science, the underlying physiology, and the connection of their discipline to this broader arena of chronic disease prevention and health management using complementary alternative medical constructs. At least that's the way they might be trivialized in the minds of individuals who don't understand them. As we then moved through the symposium, obviously we went from Dr. Sternberg's presentation into that of Dr. Michael Hollick, who talked about how vitamin D modulates immune and inflammatory process, which resulted in a standing ovation from the attendees for the brilliant and eloquent tour de force that he presented about how vitamin D is more than just a vitamin to prevent rickets and its interrelationship with immunological function, neurological function, cardiovascular function, and endocrine function, showing its principal role as a important prohormone in the regulation of gene expression and ultimately the defense against many chronic diseases of aging. From that, then, we went into a discussion of the gene-environment interaction with immunological function, and Dr. Peter Lesouf, School of Pediatrics and Child Health at the University of Western Australia, did a magnificent job of outlining aspects of the gene-environment interaction with immunological problems, focusing on Th2-dominant conditions, B-cell-mediated asthma and eczema, and showing that this concept of the environmental hygiene theory of asthma is too simplistic, and that there are these very remarkable relationships between environment and asthma that cut beyond that of specific genotypes. And he actually went on to show that there are greater diversities of response to the environment in one individual ethnic group than there is in variations among the groups, suggesting that race is not the determinant for asthma, but more is the environment. In fact, he went on to point out that 65% of the condition appears to be more environmentally related, only 35% related specifically to genotype. So yes, there is a genetic linkage, but it is not the overwhelming cause of this increasing prevalence of asthma and atopy, the so-called Th2-mediated immunological disorders. And that was obviously a theme that followed through the whole of the week's symposium, the conditions that modulate this subtle immunological balance between the thymus-dependent 1 immunological functions and the thymus-dependent 2 immunological functions, one being more related to the innate immunity, the other more to the acquired or adaptive immunity. And what was pointed out is that imbalances, infections, trauma, ischemia, poor quality diet and psychological stress can relate to dysfunction in that balance, then tipping the balance either towards a Th1-dominant or a Th2-dominant condition, with either then getting into systemic inflammatory conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, Th1-dominant, that has its own constellation of inflammatory mediators associated with it, like interleukin-1, interleukin-2, tumor necrosis factor alpha, or tipping it into the Th2-dominant type of dominant conditions that are associated with adaptive or acquired immunity, which have to do with a different family of cytokines like interleukin-4, interleukin-10, interleukin-12, and the different constellation of conditions that are associated with that, which are more tissue-specific inflammation like asthma or eczema. So as we went through this whole discussion over the week, we recognized that complementary alternative medicine is really not complementary alternative medicine. It is the best medicine for the management of many of these conditions because it leads to normalization or balance of these imbalanced immunological neuroendocrine functions. And I think that was an overview of what was achieved through the week-long discussion starting in the pre-course and working through the plenary sessions and into the workshops. As you probably recognize, in a symposium that has this broad a breadth, it's hard to come away with the takeaway. Rather, what we recognize is that there are many inputs into the dysregulation of the immune system that cut across many different clinical conditions and ICD-9 diagnostic codes and subspecialties of medicine. So no one owns this particular area of concern. It is part of all of medicine. And we certainly learned that beautifully from the eloquent presentation by Dr. Colleen Hayes from the Department of Biochemistry, University of Wisconsin, who talked about the vitamin D endocrine system and its relationship to autoimmune diseases, specifically focusing on things like rheumatoid arthritis, systemic lupus erythematosus, and multiple sclerosis. In her discussion, I think it was obvious that there are many variables that influence the balance of the immunological system and as a consequence then regulate signaling at the genomic level that then creates the outcome in the cell, tissue, organ system, and whole body that we call either function or dysfunction. Again, her presentation was so well put together and so magnificently presented that it resulted in her getting a standing ovation at the close of her talk as well. That was followed up with a magnificent presentation by Dr. Burton Berkson, many of who you recall because he has been a Functional Medicine Update Clinician of the Month twice now. And he talked about the work that he shared with us on Functional Medicine Update related to hepatic inflammatory disorders and what he calls his triple therapy, which, as you know, is use of lipoic acid, selenium, and silymarin for the management of various types of hepatic inflammatory oxidative stress-related illnesses. Going through a number of case histories and patient experiences and the basic science underlies it, once again, very convincing as to the important therapeutic role that this triple therapy has in these conditions. And then lastly, in the plenary sections, we finished up with a magnificent call to arms by Dr. Wafi Fauzi from the Harvard School of Public Health, the principal author, as you probably recall, in the work related recently in the New England Journal of Medicine pertaining to a nutritional supplementation in individuals who are HIV positive, in which he demonstrated very clear evidence that nutritional intervention with greater than RDA levels of specific nutrients would enhance survival and lower infection and some of the adverse consequences of AIDS in sub-equatorial Africa. So again, that reminded us that sometimes low technology, low expense therapies can be very important for supporting proper immunological function, which certainly was mirrored by the presentation by Dr. Maidani that occurred during the pre-course of the symposium, her work at Tufts University School of Medicine and the Human Nutrition Center on Aging in Boston, has been on nutrient impacts on immunological function, and she showed that vitamin E has a very important role in older age individuals in improving immunological function. Again, she did a dose response clinical intervention trial, which I thought was quite fascinating, showing that somewhere around 200 international units per day seemed to be the maximum effective dose for individuals on a daily intake of vitamin E for the promotion of immunological function, that at too low levels you got lowered activity and at too high levels you got lowered activity. So there was that bell-shaped parabolic dose response curve, which I think we can say holds true for virtually everything. There's a parabolic dose response curve for water and for oxygen. Too little, we die of dehydration or hypoxia. Too much, we die of hyperhydration or we die of hyperoxygenation. And so similar with every substance, there's this parabolic dose response curve. And what we want to be in, obviously, is the zone of optimal regulation. And that's individualized to some extent to that person. And that's why personalized medicine becomes very important, and why the medicine for the averages is probably going to produce the outcome of the averages relative to health care. And so as we move in this direction of personalizing medicine in the post-genomic era, we recognize that it takes us beyond just asking the questions of what is the diagnosis to understanding what is the functional medicine assessment, what are the antecedents, the triggers, the mediators that ultimately result in the signs and symptoms that patient expresses, And how does that interrelate then to interactions with and alterations of the neuroendocrine immune system? It's that complex system that seems to be the switching device between external agents in the environment and internal functional changes, the neuroendocrine immune system. So I think that the symposium helped to really bring these thoughts to greater clarity and give us some new tools and insights. We had a number of remarkable workshops that talked about the specific implementation of these concepts. Dr. Robert Roundtree's workshops on nutrient interventions to regulate TH1 and TH2 function was stellar, had tremendous review of the literature and a lot of clinical wisdom associated with it. And what we're starting to recognize is that these environmental perturbing factors play a major role in modulating immunological, endocrine, and neurological function that ultimately give rise on a trajectory towards either high function or dis-ease. And with that in mind, we should remind you, those of you who may have not had the privilege of coming to the symposium, or those of you who might have felt in an overwhelmed state, you might want to come back and get the tapes for the symposium. I think they will turn out to be classics relative to the evolution of this field. And I, in some ways, wish that we would have had every one of the contributors to the Institute of Medicine's book on complementary and alternative medicine at this symposium. Had there been, I think we would have been able to raise the bar even higher with the understanding that many of these concepts have very strong scientific underpinnings and really fulfill the criteria of the rule of reasonableness in terms of their effectiveness and safety. With all of that in mind, let's then focus this issue of functional medicine update on some of the impact of what we learned at the symposium on the neurological system, because there was certainly a tremendous amount of outcome variables related to the presentations on immune function that really had relationship to the neurological system. We recognize that there are immunological cells that are embedded within the nervous system, and these are the microglial cells, and they get their messages in part not only from neurological messages, but also from environmental messages and cues that come from the immune system. We learned at the symposium that there are actually routes of entry across the blood-brain barrier for the immune system messages from the cytokines, the TH1 and TH2 cytokines, that can then modify the functional outcome of the microglia, which then communicates with the neurons through the release of second signal messengers, like nitric oxide, for instance, and that means that the brain can be influenced by the immunological status of the host. And I think we all recognize that when you have the flu, your brain doesn't feel that capable of carrying on high-level function and thinking well, and generally you have, in the case of a very bad flu, where you have a serious immunological upregulation, you not only have a fever, but you also have all sorts of funny thoughts and your brain chemistry is disturbed. And this is a consequence of the very high load of the various inflammatory mediators that are there to try to defend against the infection that are also influencing brain chemistry. We know, therefore, that these antigen-presenting cells, the dendritic cells, and the interrelationship they have ultimately with response to immunological activators can influence the brain and brain chemistry. This may explain in part why it is that individuals that are gluten sensitive, that continue to consume gluten throughout their life, have increased statistical incidence of dementia at earlier life, because maybe the interrelationship between immune upregulation and brain chemistry connects ultimately to neuronal apoptosis or cell death and dementia. These are statistics that are fairly well regarded, and in fact, people with non-specific neurological problems like gait disturbances and so forth have now been recommended that they should have gluten sensitivity testing using either alpha-gliadin testing or gliomorphin testing to look at the potential reactivity they have to food reactive proteins coming from glutinous grains and how that could influence in neurological function. I'm now quoting from articles that have appeared in the last several years in the journal Neurology. So we recognize these dendritic cells link the innate or basic cell-mediated immune system with the adaptive immune system, the so-called immune tolerance system, through the B cells, the TH2 system. As these specialized antigen-presenting cells have profound influence over the immune response, they then induce specific leukocyte subpopulations that then release their own types of immune modulators. These are the so-called TH1 cytokines and TH2 cytokines. We know that there's a tremendous amount yet to learn about the basic biology of these dendritic cells. However, we recognize now that the toll-like receptors that sit on the surface of the innate immune system sense pathogen-associated molecular patterns and go on then to release substances that influence then the Th2 system or the acquired immune system. So these are in communication one with the other through these toll-like receptors that appear on the surface of your innate immune system. This finding has ramifications, obviously, for clinical immunotherapy protocols and provides a satisfying link between the morphology of the dendritic cell and their migration into other tissues. This active movement of membrane extensions of the dendritic cell, like phagocytosis, and the simultaneous disappearance of various pseudopods suggest a coordinated deployment to fuel this pathogen-driven effects so that the immune system is responding to viruses or bacteria. So we actually see this vigilance system kind of in real time morphing its way through the body's tissue, doing a seek and destroy type of reconnaissance mission. And that explains even in the brain how immune cells can be found within the brain itself, actually doing seek and destroy. And if they're activated, they can produce their own oxidants, as these phagocytic cells do, through the activation of the so-called hypochlorite pathway that produces OCl- that goes on into producing superoxide and hydrogen peroxide and even possibly hydroxyl radical through the Fenton reaction. So it increases oxidative stress. So one of the things that we can say about activating immunological systems is that they are associated with increased oxidative stress, or oxidative stress is often associated with immunological alteration. They kind of go hand in hand. This would raise questions, wouldn't it, about things that we're commonly associated with in our diets that may be immunological activators, and the one that I just mentioned was gluten. And we know that gluten is a food of one, but maybe, quote, the poison of another, end quote. The question is, how early then to expose an immunological system to a potential antigenic stimulus or something that activates toll receptors and initiates this memory effect within the B cells of alarm? And that gets into this concept of infant exposure to glutinous grains or cereals. And as you probably recall, that recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association was an article entitled Risk of Celiac Disease Autoimmunity and Timing of Gluten Introduction in the Diet of Infants at Increased Risk of Disease. And in this particular paper, they went on to say that there shouldn't be early introduction of gluten-containing grains to a naive immune system in an infant, and they're calling for periods of introduction that would be greater than 6 to 8 months before introduction of cereal grains containing gluten. So I think it's, again, dependent on the immunological uniqueness of that infant as to how responsive they might be. And once you prime the system, as this article goes on to say, you then have a tolerance problem that may persist throughout the rest of that individual's life because they now have a heightened sense of response to that potential antigenic protein. By the way, those of you who want to follow up on this article, it's the Journal of American Medical Association, volume 293, page 2343 in 2005. And again, showing the relative frequency of CD4 positive individuals and those who carry specific genetic risk factors like HLA, DR3 or DR4 alleles that have increasing sensitivity to gluten in their diet. The next area that we discussed beyond that of food sensitizing agents was emotional stress itself as a toxic event that can prime or modify the immunological system and this balance between Th1 and Th2. You probably have seen recently this very interesting article that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine entitled Neurohumoral Features of Myocardial Stunting Due to Sudden Emotional Stress, in which they were really looking at how neuroimmune endocrine functions are modified by acute sudden emotional stress. And in this particular paper that appeared once again in volume 352, page 539 in the New England Journal of Medicine, this is 2005, they showed that emotional stress could precipitate severe but yet reversible left ventricular dysfunction in patients without coronary disease. So in the absence of elevated cholesterol, in the absence of elevated hsCRP, in the absence of elevated triglycerides, these individuals had left ventricular dysfunction post-serious stress response. The exaggerated sympathetic stimulation is probably central to the cause of this syndrome and once again demonstrates the very close connection between the HPA axis and myocardial function, the hypothalamus-pituitary-adrenal axis. And this is, of course, one of the features that Dr. Sternberg was addressing in the Cellier stress model in her presentations at the 12th International Symposium. We also recognize as a consequence, therefore, of these catechol-driven functions in the vascular system that heart rate profiles during exercise is a very important predictor of sudden death and maybe one of the better diagnostic tools for defining whether a person is at risk to sudden cardiac death. I'm now quoting from another paper that appeared recently in the New England Journal of Medicine. This is volume 352, page 1951 in 2005, in which they found that the heart rate profile during exercise and recovery was a predictor of sudden death and was probably more predictive than were things like serum lipids and other traditional cardiovascular risk factors. This was a study done actually in 5,713 asymptomatic working men between the ages of 42 and 53 years, none of whom had clinically detectable cardiovascular disease, and underwent standardized graded exercise testing using the Bruce protocol between 1967 and 72. The data was examined on the subject's resting heart rates, the increase in rate from resting level to the peak exercise level, and then the time it took for recovery back to their basic resting pulse and the level of pulse after 1 minute post-exercise. What was found is that the more resilient that heart function was, in other words, the faster that heart rate went up on exercise, the more able it was to recover after exercise to come back down, and the lower the resting pulse, all were indicators of good cardiovascular function. I would call it organ reserve, cardiovascular organ reserve, to continue to use the term that we've employed over the years. And as the resting pulse goes up, as the differential between resting and exercise pulse goes down, as the rate of recovery of pulse is slowed, that demonstrates lowered plasticity within the cardiovascular system, and it indicates increased relative risk to sudden cardiac death upon a precipitating event. So again, this concept of homeodynamic function, of plasticity, of organ reserve as measures of functionality, as contrasted to just looking for alterations in an EKG that are suggestive of cardiopathology, may be better markers for picking up earlier states of dysfunction that are modifiable by intervention. Well, that also raises the question, doesn't it, about cardiac rhythm variability, or the whole called heart math approach. And I find this autonomic tone and its relationship to cardiovascular risk profiles to be a very important part of our learning system. This is the dangers of chronic fight or flight, the chronic stress effect on vascular function. I owe Dr. Jean Alexander, one of our functional medicine colleagues, thanks for tipping me off on this extraordinary paper that was published recently in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, because I think it's a very valuable tool to add to our assessment armamentarium. This appeared in volume 77, page 45, in January of 2002 in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings. The title of this paper is Autonomic Tone as Cardiovascular Risk Factors. This is work done from Brian Curtis and Jim O'Keefe from the Mid-America Heart Institute at St. Luke's Hospital, University of Kansas. What they really looked at were things that were traditional biochemical markers of hypertension and cardiovascular function, such as angiotensin-converting enzyme, calcium effects in relationship with serum lipids, a congestive heart failure, left ventricular function. And what they found is that autonomic dysfunction is a very powerful risk factor for sudden coronary events. And if you look again at heart rate recovery after exercise, confirming what was discussed in the recent New England Journal of Medicine paper, 5-year mortality was extraordinarily lower in those patients who had very rapid recovery from those who have low recovery rates after exercise. They also looked at heart rhythm variability. This falls a lot into the heart math concepts. In other words, fine structure EKG or electrocardiogram diversity, which is seen as increasing physiological degrees of freedom that indicates plasticity, that indicates organ reserve. In highly trained athletes that are very fit, you have a tremendous amount of fine structure variability in their heart rhythms. Whereas in people that become less healthy and lose cardiovascular reserve, eventually becoming ill, having cardiopathies, their fine structure becomes much more simple and their EKG actually gets simpler rather than more complex. So the more complex EKGs are associated with this biological variability, which is associated with fitness. When I say fitness, I really mean physiological, biological fitness, as to contrasted to those individuals who have more simple EKG patterns. And of course, the simplest is a flatline EKG, which we associate with a lack of function in its totality. So the point that they're making in this article is that high autonomic tone, driven by adrenaline, driven by the flight or fight, causes lowered heart rate variability, poor recovery after exercise, and is as important a risk factor as any specific risk factor that's ever been evaluated for determining the relative risk of sudden coronary events. So they say that the things that we ought to be looking at clinically are things like resting heart rate greater than 90 beats a minute, inability to achieve 85% of predicted maximal heart rate on a treadmill test, abnormal heart rate recovery, which is failure to decrease heart rate to less than 12 beats per minute during the first minute after peak exercise. So you take your peak exercise pulse rate, you sit down and rest for a minute after exercise, and if it doesn't come down 12 beats, that's an indication of poor recovery. And abnormal heart rate variability, meaning the failure to change heart rate or the resting rate interval by 10 beats per minute during the 1 minute of slow deep breaths after exercise. So these are indications of very significant reductions in what might be called vascular fitness or vascular plasticity. And this study on autonomic tone related to cardiovascular risk ties itself very beautifully together with the New England Journal of Medicine paper, Heart Rate Profile During Exercise. So as you're doing cardiovascular testing, I think this concept of heart rate variability during after exercise, resting pulse rate, and recovery rate are extraordinarily important in defining some of these things that are related to the psychology and the neuropsychology and neuropsychoimmunology of stress, distress, driven by the autonomic nervous system. Well, let's move from that to a discussion of hemodynamic responses to stress and its interrelationship with plasma homocysteine. As you well recognize from the discussions that we've had over the years, if we're talking about immunological, neurological, and endocrine imbalances that are based on clinical chemistry, one of them that has emerged is the Kilmer-McCulley concept of hyperhomocysteemia, or elevated homocysteine levels in the blood. Individuals have been looking at ways of modulating homocysteine levels in the blood and looking also at the effect that high homocysteine has on endothelial function. It could be endothelial function of the vasculature, which could include not only the cardiovascular system, but the brain system itself, and how these interrelate then to a variety of clinical outcome variables. I was very pleased to see this recent paper that appeared in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 135, page 212 in 2005, entitled Oral L-Arginine Improving Hemodynamic Response to Stress and Reducing Plasma Homocysteine in Hypercholesterolemic Men. This follows very nicely from the presentations that Dr. John Cook from Stanford University made at our symposia a few years ago in Tucson, Arizona, in which he described the work that he'd been doing in the cardiovascular biology area, looking at the role first in baboons and then in humans of arginine supplementation in improving vascular endothelial function. In this particular study, what they did is an intravenous administration of L-arginine, and they show that it substantially reduced in humans blood pressure and peripheral vascular resistance in patients with vascular disease. Oral L-arginine was also shown to improve endothelial function. However, they're not sure whether the oral administration had a significant effects on systemic hemodynamics. They then did a randomized placebo-controlled crossover study where they tested oral arginine 12 grams per day for 3 weeks and looked at hemodynamic glucose, insulin, or C-reactive protein in 16 middle-aged men with hyperstressor tasks. This was a simulated public speaking task and a cold pressor test. I can certainly identify with the public speaking task as a simulated stressor task. Regardless of treatment, the stressor task increased blood pressure and heart rate. Relative to placebo, L-arginine changed cardiac output by lowering it 0.4 liters per minute, decreased diastolic blood pressure by approximately 2 millimeters of mercury, had a positive impact on pre-ejection period, and lowered plasma homocysteine by about 2 micromoles per liter. The change in plasma L-arginine was inversely correlated with the change in plasma homocysteine in this study. And contrary to the results of previous studies with L-arginine administered intravenously, oral arginine did not affect total peripheral resistance or plasma insulin. Oral L-arginine also did not affect plasma glucose, C-reactive protein, or lipids. And the pattern seems to be consistent with the hypothesis that oral L-arginine reduces blood pressure when administered in fairly high doses, in this case about 12 grams per day given in 3 to 4 gram divided doses. We also recognize that diets that are very high in L-arginine, these would be basically your vegetable protein-rich diets, which are higher in composition of L-arginine and lower in composition of L-lysine as contrasted to animal protein-rich diets. These diets are also associated with lowered levels of C-reactive protein, inflammatory mediators, and reduced blood pressure. And this may be one of the many variables that influences in the DASH trials the dietary approaches to stopping hypertension, the lowering of blood pressure in those vegetable-based diets. Not only is it calcium, magnesium, and potassium, but it also may be related to things like amino acid composition with increased arginine dietary intake in the vegetable proteins. I'm now quoting actually from a recent paper entitled Association Between Dietary Arginine and C-reactive Protein that appeared in the journal Nutrition, volume 21, page 125 in 2005. And the results of this study showed a very strong relationship between dietary arginine intake and a lowered CRP level that persisted after controlling for other factors. They go on to say that individuals may be able to lower their risk to inflammation-induced cardiovascular disease by consuming more of these arginine-rich foods. And it's interesting to note that this effect that arginine has on endothelial nitric oxide, which then causes vasorelaxation and has a positive effect on endothelial redox levels, you might say, well, gee whiz, couldn't you do similar things by giving a drug like sildenafil? Because sildenafil or Viagra influences GMP and nitric oxide and so forth, so couldn't that have a positive effect on cardiovascular function in some individuals? And ironically, there is now emerging evidence that an off-label use for sildenafil may be in individuals who have specific types of cardiopathies. I'm now quoting from a recent paper that appeared in Nature Medicine, Volume 11, page 115 in 2005, that goes on to say that Viagra or sildenafil operates by increasing the levels of cyclic GMP in target cells, and this mechanism underlies a discovered action of how it may improve heart function in individuals who have hypertrophic heart activity. So again, what we're starting to witness is that by modulating these endothelial nitric oxide functions and interrelationship with cyclic GMP in endothelial cells, that there can be some very profound positive normalizing effects. I'm not advocating sildenafil. What I'm advocating is possibly the diet that is immune modulating that has these nutrients that help to regulate endothelial nitric oxide function. What about simple things like play and exercise? Can they help prevent then immunological imbalance that can produce inflammatory response that can result in things like amyloid buildup in the brain? I mean, that's a fairly interesting complementary alternative medicine concept, isn't it? That by proper play and proper exercise that you can protect your brain from amyloid buildup. Well, that's not just a bunch of speculation. Recently in Science Magazine, Volume 307, page 1547 in 205, was a wonderful article describing work that's being published now on how play and exercise in animals is able to protect against neuritic plaque or amyloid buildup and may thereby be seen as a preventive agent for things like Alzheimer's. Well, what about neurotoxicity that relates to heavy metal association, things like mercury and lead? We come back to revisit old things in new ways, but certainly those also influence neuroimmune endocrine function and can lead to neurobehavioral dysfunction. We see in a recent paper in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 293, page 1875 in 2005, the paper that says that data did not provide a strong support that blood mercury levels are associated with worse neurobiobehavioral performance. But if you start looking at subgroups within this study size, you start seeing that individuals with specific elevations of mercury have significant reductions in cognitive performance and neurobehavioral problems. And certainly we know that the response to heavy metals is very individualized. We learned that from Vera Stegshall many years ago from Ostra, the scientist immunologist who showed us that there can be a variation of response in the order of 100,000 from person to person in how they respond to heavy metal toxicity. And of course, don't forget lead. We still know that lead has a decremental effect upon brain biochemical function and neurocognitive function. Again, as we look at follow-up recently in the JAMA, Volume 293, page 2232 in 2005, there's a very good article on the follow-up testing among children with elevated blood lead levels showing increased neurobehavioral difficulties, confirming what we learned nearly 30 years ago from work done that was accomplished at Mass General Hospital showing that children with marginal elevations of blood lead levels had reduced neurocognitive performance and behavior. So I think there is much around the immune system that interfaces with the neurological system, that interfaces with the endocrine system, that gives rise to dysfunction. And this is not just complementary alternative medicine we're talking about. We're talking about good science based upon good medicine. And so maybe functional medicine from this perspective would be considered the best medicine for these kinds of chronic problems. Well, that leads us into our clinician of the month this month. We're very excited to have to share advancing concepts related to the neurological implications of these concerns. Well, we're back to that section of Functional Medicine Update that I know really is that which we look forward to each month, and that is the clinician or the researcher of the month. And we're coming right out of what is the most successful symposium that the Institute for Functional Medicine has ever been privileged to host, and that was our 12th International Symposium on the Immune System Under Siege. And one of the dominant themes that came out of that symposium, for those of you that were not there, was the topic of neuroimmune endocrinology, or however you want to put those words together as one long word, that relates to these complex disorders that cut across subspecialties of medicine. And it's hard to isolate individual organ systems, but rather you have to look at the systems biology level to understand things like multiple sclerosis or systemic lupus erythematosus or inflammatory bowel disease. And that was certainly the message that came through loud and clear at our symposium. So I thought this month in Functional Medicine Update, following up on that theme, that it would be wise to go back and revisit so-called Back to the Future, a clinician visionary that we've had the privilege of talking with before, Dr. David Perlmutter, neurologist in Naples, Florida, who has really helped us all see a perspective as to where functional neurology can go and how that might interconnect with immunology and endocrinology. Just to remind those of you who may not be familiar with Dr. Perlmutter's background, he graduated from Florida State University and then the University of Miami School of Medicine and did research at the University of Florida in neurosurgery and microneurosurgery. Has been in private practice now in Naples, Florida for a number of years with the Perlmutter Health Center that is really focusing on complex relationships that connect to neurological function. He has been a pioneer in the area of hyperbarics. He's been a pioneer in the area of nutritional intervention and is author of the recent best-selling book, The Better Brain Book, that was delivered into the bookstores in 2004 and has received a tremendous amount of very justifiable media attention for his work and his book. Dr. Perlmutter, once again, welcome to Functional Medicine Update and thanks for being able to spend some time with us.
Jeff, it is absolutely my pleasure.
Let me, if I can, go back and pick up a little bit from where we left off in May of 1999. Hard to believe it was now going on 6 years ago that we had our last discussion on FMU. You painted a mosaic of what functional neurology looked like in 1999, and obviously now 6 years downstream, and a JAMA article that appeared a couple of years ago on Parkinsonism that looked very much like the David Perlmutter picture that you painted in 1999, suggesting that even the JAMA is picking up on these trends. What have you seen as the nature of the change in the field that you have so significantly contributed to?
Jeff, I'd like to paint a better picture and come to you from a position of more optimism, but I'm afraid that I'm not seeing a whole heck of a lot of progress from at least the general purveyance of neurology to the American populace. We really do not focus at all upon prevention of disease, and yet we know that diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's have obvious causes and indeed should be considered preventable disease. One of the things that's happened to me over the past couple of years is I've been doing a lot more mainstream media kind of education, along with the education pursuits with our peers. I've been trying to get the word out in the mainstream that these are diseases for which we have no cure, and yet diseases which are preventable, and this is where our emphasis needs to be. And you mentioned things like the Journal of the American Medical Association, and I would call to attention other publications by the American Medical Association, like the Archives of Neurology, which is put up by the AMA. And in fact, in January of 2004, they published an article that demonstrated that those individuals, for example, with the highest levels of vitamin C and E, had a 78% risk reduction for Alzheimer's disease. And another report showing that, actually by the same research, showing that those who had the highest levels of DHA had a 70% risk reduction for Alzheimer's disease. And these articles were then followed in June of 2004 by a very interesting report in the journal Lancet that demonstrated that the main drug, donepezil, used so-called for treatment of Alzheimer's, doesn't even work. So here we have a situation where the public is being led to believe, to live their lives come what may, And then when suddenly you don't have both oars in the water at the same time, you're starting to forget where you put your keys, why there's a pharmaceutical rescue for you called donepezil, which we see advertised on the evening news every night and in every trade magazine. And that's going to be your way out. Well, here we know now that the drug doesn't work. There is no drug to cure Alzheimer's, and yet there's powerful information out there indicating that there are very important risk factors to which we should pay attention, to wit, the antioxidants, things that we have talked about for a long time, like homocysteine, other risk markers like C-reactive protein, and even genomic testing indicating a possible risk, like looking at the ApoE alleles. So it's, I guess, a little bit difficult to conceive of a way to light that single candle in the darkness when the darkness is really almost overpowering the American population with media. Again, that's convincing them that lifestyle doesn't have any role to play, and that when these problems arise, whether they're heart disease, hypertension, malignancy, depression, or dementia, that there's going to be a quick drug fix, which is really unfortunately still to the American way and has taken hold. So we're going to still stay out there and try to be that candle in the darkness, but it's very, very difficult to see what is happening to the American population, both young and old. When we realize that, for example, the rates of autism going from the 1980s to where we are now have increased tenfold, to the extent that we now have one in every 166 children is going to be autistic. And we know that there are powerful risk factors that are modifiable, and we know that there are individuals who can be identified based upon genomic testing to be at risk for that problem, and we can make changes in their environment, identifying these kids up front, and make changes to reduce risk and therefore the incidence of these very devastating issues. That's the short answer.
Yeah, and that's a very good way to start into this discussion, I think. I'd like to just muse with you for a moment. I know that this is speculation, but I'd like to get your opinion. When I look back to when I started in this field, which was in the 60s, late 1960s, there was, at that point, I think an analogous discussion that was ongoing related to the prevention of heart disease. And I recall at that point the principal thought about diet and heart disease was the polyunsaturate to saturate ratio. That's what most people were focusing on. But the problem was really everybody else's problem, because there wasn't a marker for individual risk to heart disease. Then with the development of the Boehringer-Mannheim fingerstick cholesterol test and the Framingham study, then suddenly people could have their own number, and that was their cholesterol number. And then the risk went from somebody else's to their own specific risk. And obviously, coupled with that very closely was the development of the statin drugs for the management of that indicator. I'm thinking there might be some kind of an analogy here, because you've obviously articulated very clearly that we've got this nearly epidemic increase in dementia-related disorders that are going to be increasing in frequency with an aging population, yet we're not responding in the way that we should to prevent unnecessary health expenditures and human suffering. And is this at all analogous, do you think, to the heart disease thing?
I think absolutely that it is. I mean, I think it's very clear that the most important factor in raising public awareness is the development of a drug to treat a specific ill. We've seen that with ADHD. We've seen it with cholesterol, as you pointed out. Really, what has caused the rise in public awareness, cholesterol, has been the creation of the cholesterol-lowering drugs. Why is it that 90% of the patients that I see every day have never heard of the term homocysteine? Because there's not a drug fix for homocysteine, and they've therefore not been made aware of it. So I think the control of the media and the role that that plays in terms of public awareness is absolutely vast. I mean, you bring up the idea about cholesterol, and we're all certainly aware of the new information indicating that those individuals who are involved in determining what are the safe levels of cholesterol have been involved in some ways with the pharmaceutical industry, which is in many ways an issue that needs more attention. Therefore, their edicts that they issue in terms of what should be a safe cholesterol issue is in many ways influenced by the manufacturers of the various drugs to lower cholesterol. And we know that there are very significant issues with safety of cholesterol-lowering drug. We know that there's a large segment of the population who develops transient myalgias, muscle pain, and disability from those drugs, and a certain percentage of those individuals are left with permanent issues with reference to muscle dysfunction, which really ultimately is probably going to turn out to be a mitochondrial dysfunction at the level of muscle. We also know that there's a 16-fold increased risk of neuropathy in individuals taking statin drugs. And now comes a report in the journal Neurology that was published 3 or 4 days ago from researchers at Johns Hopkins. The study was called, if I recall correctly, High Total Cholesterol Levels in Late Life Associated with Reduced Risk of Dementia. Now, what did I just say? I said that dementia risk was reduced in those individuals with the highest cholesterol. So maybe cholesterol does play some important positive roles in our physiology. We know that cholesterol is, in fact, a precursor to hormones, but also functions in the brain as an antioxidant. And these researchers demonstrated that in individuals age 70, that the risk of dementia was decreased by almost 70% in those in the highest quartile of total cholesterol. So it tells us that it's time to really take a step back and maybe reevaluate, at least from a general population perspective, what exactly are we doing when we're pumping our population full of these statin drugs that have such devastating effects on enzyme pathways, which can modulate and reduce the availability of important antioxidants like coenzyme Q10. Shouldn't we take a step back when the FDA is considering making statin drugs over-the-counter like they've done in England? When we now see that, in fact, cholesterol is not such a terrible thing, that the good Lord put it there for maybe some important reasons.
I think you've really hit on some very important issues here, and cholesterol became a buzzword because it was easily analyzed and it was associated with a relative risk that came out of epidemiological studies. So one might ask the same question relative to dementia-related illnesses. Are there any functional markers that you could see that we could use in patients to evaluate, like we do with cholesterol for heart disease, functional neurological problems before the onset of dementia?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've been talking a long time about the role of free radicals and therefore antioxidants in reducing risk. One of the studies that we like to use is looking at the urine lipid peroxides. We use that as one of the four key markers of risk prediction in terms of neurodegenerative conditions like dementia and Alzheimer's, along with C-reactive protein, homocysteine, and looking at the ApoE alleles. But this idea that oxidative damage may relate to cognitive decline was actually recently published in the journal Neurology. Researchers, University of Kentucky in Lexington, in fact, demonstrated a direct correlation in risk for minimal cognitive impairment all the way to early Alzheimer's disease, and correlated that risk with measuring the T-bar study, which is something, obviously, that you've been talking about, you and I have been lecturing about for years. Now it comes out that there's this direct relationship, which we all suspected, but even more importantly, that the pathological changes taking place in the brain, i.e. the development of these so-called neuritic plaques in the superior and middle temporal gyrus region, directly correlates, beautiful linear correlation with measurement of the thiobarbituric acid reactive substances, which is a simple at-home study that has profound implications. So taking it a step back then, one would say, then what can a person do lifestyle-wise that might reduce the production of these or modifying these fats by action of free radicals? There's perfect support, therefore, for the role of antioxidants, and that supports the study that I talked to you about earlier about reduced risk of Alzheimer's in people with highest levels of vitamin C and E. So absolutely, in terms of things that can be done that are not overly invasive, I think looking at studies like serum or urine for thiobarbituric acid reactive substances, a simple test, I think looking at highly sensitive C-reactive protein as a marker of inflammation, knowing that the balance of various fatty acids in the body plays a very important role in the whole inflammatory cascade and therefore has a bearing on the outcome of that test. Looking at homocysteine and recognizing that risk for Alzheimer's will double at the level of 14 and above. We have a great degree of debt that we owe Dr. Kilmer McCulley, as you're so familiar with, for bringing homocysteine to the public's attention because it's so desperately important. And finally, looking at the ApoE profile to determine, in fact, who is at increased risk, who carries the ApoE4 allele. And when we identify people who happen to carry that allele, recognizing that this then has a direct relationship on the outcome in terms of the thiobarbituric studies, that carrying the ApoE4 allele down-regulates the brain's antioxidant protective abilities and therefore places a person at increased risk for diseases like Alzheimer's and also increased risk for having a worse outcome following head injury, having a more rapid decline following the diagnosis of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, having an increased risk of having prolonged seizures following a seizure in childhood. A variety of issues that we all now know are antioxidant dependent.
Dr. Perlmutter, really you've pioneered this thought in the minds of the medical community, let's call it the functional medicine community in the world, and that's the connection of these antioxidants to the glutathione-glutathione disulfide couple, one of the principal antioxidant systems in the body. In fact, in terms of numbers of molecules, the probably most prevalent antioxidant system in the body. So what's the status right now of your extraordinary work with intravenous glutathione and some of the work that you were going to be engaged in?
I'm not sure how we stumbled into the glutathione thing, I guess now, 12 years ago. Actually, I'll tell you, I do remember. We had a patient here. We were using glutathione after I attended a lecture on chronic fatigue, and one of the lecturers had mentioned that they had noted low levels of glutathione in chronic fatigue patients, so we started giving glutathione to patients with chronic fatigue, and I had one patient one day carrying that diagnosis and a diagnosis of Parkinson's, and it was one of those, as Jeff Bland would say, aha moments when we gave him the glutathione and he got out of his wheelchair. I mean, you hear stories like that, and I'm such a non-believer, but when I watched that happen in my office, I had to take notice and pursue it. As Pasteur says, chance favors the prepared mind. So we began digging deep and found that indeed Dr. Secchi had done a study in Italy and indicated that he saw significant improvement in people receiving intravenous glutathione. So be that as it may, we researched it, began using it with our Parkinson's patients, and over the years, and as I'm sure you're well aware, glutathione has become a real focal point as a key brain antioxidant, as a chelating agent in the body, as a key player in hepatic detoxification, so therefore a very important focal point in the neurodegenerative conditions. Well, what we've been able to do is obtain an IRB for a research study of giving the intravenous glutathione in Parkinson's patients, and we are one patient away from completing that study and are very excited that that's finally going to be completed and able to publish the results, which hopefully will demonstrate that this is as effective not only in symptom management, but also in terms of reducing the progression of that disease. Of course, the code hasn't been broken, but I'm hopeful that it's going to prove positive. But along the way, so many other literature citations have come out that support the contention and support the important role that glutathione plays. Just last week, it was found on PubMed, ahead of publication, a study that I guess will appear this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, where they looked at glutathione as transferase activity, and found that in Drosophila, the fruit fly that had carried the mutation of the Parkin gene, which led to the degeneration of the dopaminergic neurons, that the loss of these function of these dopaminergic neurons because of this Parkin gene mutation was enhanced when there were mutations of the glutathione S transferase S1 gene, and that with overexpression of the glutathione STS1 gene, that there was profound suppression of this neurodegeneration. And the abstract went on to indicate that this finding could lead to potential therapeutic interventions in the treatment of Parkinson's disease. Well, gee, that certainly sounds like great support. You know, this whole idea that these genetic risk factors can be played upon by environmental exposures, I think, is really sort of central to where functional medicine is these days, and that is that we recognize individuals having certain genetic mutations and therefore risks may or may not express disease unless acted upon by an environmental factor. That certainly would support, for example, the recent finding of these temporal and geographic variations in amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. That this would not be expected if this were a purely genetic issue, nor would it be expected if it were purely an environmental issue, that there's this interplay between those individuals who are at risk and then subsequent environmental exposure. And indeed, the work done recently by Dr. Jill James in Arkansas in identifying these genomic issues with reference to glutathione in at-risk children for autism really, I think, makes a very strong case for, I think, a reassessment on the part of science. When science tells us that there is no link between thimerosal exposure, either ethyl mercury found in thimerosal or methyl mercury found in foods, fish, and women who are pregnant, that there's no link between these exposures and the subsequent development of autism. Now that we recognize that there are profound genetic risk markers for glutathione activity, glutathione S-transferase activity, we should redo those studies and therefore determine whether or not children who carry those genetic markers are therefore at increased risk, which all the science would now dictate is a very, very fundamental, is a very strong indicator and a strong explanation as to why kids are now developing autism at the rates I quoted earlier.
You know, I want to go back just for a second to the glutathione question, because I had a couple of interesting conversations with your colleagues at the 12th International Symposium, two of whom were giving me anecdotes from their experience using intravenous glutathione in patients with various types of viral liver-related conditions, and this would be like hep C-type infections or chemical hepatitis. They both reported that using your procedure with those conditions led to significant improvement, reduction of liver enzyme profiles, and reduction of inflammation in these patients with these liver inflammatory disorders. If you think of the liver as also part of the immune system, which is part of the nervous system, which is part of the endocrine system, then maybe these observations you've made specific to the brain are generalized to many conditions that associate with enhanced upregulation of immune inflammatory conditions.
Well, what is the bottom line in terms of how any of these inflammatory issues ultimately causes illness? And ultimately, I think what we all recognize is because it does disrupt mitochondrial activity. So I think in that regard, that's been really one of the motivating forces for us to expand our usage of intravenous glutathione to a variety of illnesses. I mean, even take it past the viral hepatitis, we have included intravenous glutathione as a very, very integral part of our protocol in treating chronic Lyme disease, and have found that coupling intravenous glutathione along with hyperbarics and an appropriate antibiotic regimen has been a very powerful approach to getting these people back on their feet, quite literally, for a disease that still many of my mainstream colleagues choose to believe doesn't exist, and that is to say that they tend to look upon Lyme disease as a fairly monophasic event, that you are diagnosed, you're treated with an antibiotic, and then you are better. Well, we now know that patients are debilitated long-term, and that this issue does not just necessarily go away with a quick blast of doxycycline. It's also been shown, as of quite recently, Lyme disease ultimately does its damage by, in fact, causing mitochondrial dysfunction in a variety of tissues in the body. So, again, with reference to getting back to liver diseases specifically, there's no doubt that hepatitis and other inflammatory issues of the liver are vastly improved when you use intravenous glutathione and provide other oral nutritional precursors to upregulate glutathione production. We've seen hepatitis C viral counts go down dramatically following just at the inception of intravenous glutathione therapy. The real issue as of late for me has been the questions raised by my neurology colleagues as to blood-brain barrier penetration of the glutathione. And, I don't have any doubt that this penetration is vast and significant because of just the symptomatic improvement that we all observe. But to answer that, or maybe to get past that question, what I've been working on now is at MD Anderson in Texas, we are about to start a study where we're going to be giving glutathione intrathecally to sheep. And with the understanding from University of Miami that once we've completed that study and demonstrated safety, et cetera, that we're going to move ahead with treating ALS patients with intrathecal pumps delivering glutathione 24/7. So it's certainly taking it a lot further out of the box than the IV glutathione, but I think it's just time to make the box a little bit bigger.
Well, you know, that's certainly very consistent with one of the things that we learned at the 12th International Symposium. We saw some brilliant data showing that even large 56 kilodalton molecules that are members of the cytokine family can travel across the blood-brain barrier. In fact, I recall one of the remarkable slides in which there was a blood-brain barrier and then there was a big X across it saying it's not as impermeable as we thought. So there may be transport mechanisms or actual portals of entry for larger molecules that were previously unrecognized that allow the brain to have relationship with the rest of the body in ways that we now are only starting to recognize.
Indeed, again, to get back to the clinical application understanding, I hardly ever will treat an MS, multiple sclerosis patient, during an acute flare-up of that disease anymore with the protocol providing intravenous solumedrol or steroids. My feeling about multiple sclerosis is that we may have been, again, led down a path that needs reevaluation, much as we have been with cholesterol. And that is, if I may be so bold as to say that MS may not fundamentally be an autoimmune disease. Now, I know that's going to raise a lot of eyebrows because that's been the thesis for a number of decades. It's been the justification for all of the developed pharmaceutical interventions. But I would just simply propose that we should consider that there are a variety of bits of data that need to be reevaluated in light of the possibility that the fundamental issue in multiple sclerosis may actually be a metabolic or even an energetic failure, an energetic issue, which then thereafter paves the way for this hyperimmune response. You know, the models that have been used for MS over the years have been the cases of this acute disseminated encephalomyelitis in humans and then the experimental allergic encephalomyelitis, EAE, in laboratory animals, which in many ways are somewhat similar to MS, but in many other important ways have very little to do with MS when you look at the pathophysiology of that disease. I mean, those are both acute and monophasic issues where there is specific damage to myelin, which follows damage to the endothelium. In reality, MS is nothing like that at all, and that if the hallmark of those two diseases is this huge lymphocytic infiltrate, well, in fact, in MS plaques, many times there's very little lymphocytic infiltrate around the plaque. You know, scientists claim that because of these autoreactive T-cell clones to brain antigens, that's an indication that it is an autoimmune acute disease. But as a matter of fact, we see those antigens in other neurologic problems. We see antigens directed against myelin in a variety of other neurologic issues, including stroke, where that rise may be as high as sevenfold. We see complement activation, which is talked about as being a hallmark of MS, in head injury, and other neurodegenerative conditions. So I think it's time to reevaluate this, especially in light of new data using functional MRI, proton MR spectroscopy, showing that there is widespread neuronal loss even at the very earliest stages of this disease. And when you scan specifically for N-acetyl aspartate, which is an indication of functionality of brain tissue, that this is a very early predictor of risk of relapse in MS, indicating that the very first event may be an energetic event, a loss of neuronal function preceding this inflammatory reaction. So the thought then needs to be, shouldn't we be paying more attention to neuronal energetics and preserving neuronal function using the techniques that we've talked about to upregulate mitochondrial activity and to salvage mitochondrial activity, antioxidant function, things like coenzyme Q10, and when need be, techniques to upregulate glutathione availability and production, and even more aggressively, intravenous glutathione. I've seen the proof in the pudding in my own practice. When patients have come in the acute throes of a multiple sclerosis flare-up, and we choose not to load them with steroids, but instead give them intravenous glutathione and see resolution of symptoms often within hours when it might take several days with steroids, and here choosing a therapy that doesn't have the downsides or the risks of steroids, that in fact has virtually nothing but upsides.
Well, David, that was a remarkable, optimistic, and encouraging note, and certainly really an interesting perspective that seems to fulfill that rule of reasonableness. So thanks for sharing that. You know, we've got just a few minutes left, and I guess I would be remiss if I didn't ask you the question that's probably on the minds of many of our listeners. Since May 1999, now we're 6 years downstream and in 2005, have you seen any new clinical tools that you are really excited about, maybe not comparable to glutathione, intravenous glutathione, but some tools that you find have been added to the tool bag over those 6 years that look interesting?
Well, we're looking at a couple of things. I'm sure you're aware of the work of Dr. Patricia Kane in Philadelphia. And she has added to our glutathione protocol a phosphatidylcholine because of its role in membrane activity, both cellular, neuronal, and also at the mitochondrial level. I think that's going to turn out to be very exciting. I think transcranial magnetic approaches may also prove to be pretty darn exciting. We're seeing a lot of interesting work coming out of several laboratories, and I know you're aware of that information. I think that's going to come into its own very, very soon. There are a lot of new techniques using some time-honored nutritional supplements. We're still remaining quite excited about the role of resveratrol acting as a COX-2 inhibitor, not only in neurologic issues, but also even in terms of malignancy. But I think the biggest and most exciting thing is the new recognition of the role of fatty acid DHA, expanding role also as a COX-2 inhibitor, but even more important in terms of its role in genetic expression. And I know that's an area of much importance for you. And I think that the role of DHA in general health is going to become much more widespread, much more understood in the general public. We know that foods will soon be enriched with DHA because of the important role that it plays in gaining public awareness. So I think that getting back to something I think I spoke to at IFM back when we were in Aspen, Colorado, years and years ago about fatty acids and immune modulation and the role that they play in brain health, I think that what is exciting is the fact that it looks like science is really revisiting that and that, you know, we've come full circle in recognizing that there is some very important new information about genetic expression and modulation of genetic expression with modulation of the fatty acids that we're just going to get into in the years to come.
I want to say in close that as the 7th International Linus Pauling Functional Medicine Award winner, you uphold the tradition and honor of that award with very high integrity. We're all pleased with the kind of reception that you've gotten through your Better Brain book and the various ways that you're affecting people's belief about the fact that many of these disorders are not irreversible. In fact, the brain can heal, which is a major change in the way that I learned about neurology. And I think you've served as a beacon, and we really appreciate your continued leadership, and thanks for being with us today. I'd like to add just a few follow-on concepts to Dr. Perlmutter's very wonderful explanation of the progress that's occurring in the area of functional neurology. I'd like to go back to revisit quickly, after 14 years, the Gulf War veteran problems that we call Gulf War illness. Approximately 11% of the deployed veterans from the Gulf War have reported significant health problems similar to things that we attribute to toxicity. They have a whole range of differing clinical symptoms, and questions have asked as to whether these are real or psychogenic or post-traumatic stress syndrome. And people have said, well, hold it just a minute. These veterans were exposed to all sorts of potential causal factors that may have adverse impact upon their neuroendocrine immune systems, things that were multiple vaccinations, exposure to organic phosphate pesticides, prophylactic use of nerve agent pretreatment phytostigmine that was found even in the cerebral spinal fluid of some of these veterans after they came back. Inhalation of depleted uranium dust, exposure to low doses of nerve agent sarin after the destruction of chemical munitions, and exposure, obviously, to the burning fumes of these oil wells that were on fire. So all of these things together produce a total load, and now we're going back to reevaluate the impact that these agents may be having on immune and neurological function, and maybe the conditions that we were seeing in these veterans were not just post-traumatic stress syndrome, they were a combination of post-traumatic stress that was overlaid with these modulators of neurological function. In England, there's a very dramatic reevaluation that's now ongoing to look at the potential association between exposures during the war to these veteran disabilities. Those of you that want to learn more about this, there's a very nice discussion of this in The Lancet recently, volume 365, page 635 in 2005. I take a very personal perspective on this in that I was asked to present a number of years ago to the Bureau of Veterans Affairs and the Department of Environmental Medicine on some of the studies that we'd done on detoxification enzyme profiles and whole body toxicity in Gulf War veterans who had these symptoms of Gulf War illness. And we found very significant alterations in their urinary organic acid profiles and very significant alterations in their acetaminophen challenge detoxification results. I presented that, and I recalled the cab ride back to the airport after the meeting. I happened to be with one of the high-ranking officials in the cab, and we were alone, and he and I got into a discussion about this, and he said, you know, off the record, I'd like you to know that this is a real problem, but the difficulty is we don't really know what to do about it, so I think what will happen is it will smolder until it kind of goes away, because if we took it seriously, we're not sure exactly what to do about it. Well, that to me has remained resonant in my mind for the past 10 years, that discussion, because many things that we see that are chronic in nature, we have some fairly good evidence as to what the etiological factors are, but because we don't know how to put that through the traditional medical system to get an outcome, it's easier to either avoid the problem or to say we don't have enough data than it is to try to do something. That's similar with lead intoxication in children. If it was really acknowledged what degree this problem occurred within the United States by our government, it would then force action, and we're not sure if we have enough money to chelate every child that has elevated blood lead levels that might have adverse neuropsychological or biobehavioral effects. So these are political and economic issues that often overlay and complicate some of the fundamental issues related to the connection between an exposure and a dysfunction. That also relates to this whole homocysteine story, which, you know, has been continually considered controversial, even in the face of all the evidence that has been amassed over the last few years. Now we see elevated homocysteine is associated with fractures and spontaneous imperfections in bone density and bone formation. I'm now quoting from recent papers that appeared in the JAMA, volume 293, page 1121, showing that folate and vitamin B12, when given in high dose, can help prevent hip fractures in patients who have had stroke because of the relationship it has between lowering inflammation induced by homocysteine and how inflammation activates osteolytic osteolysis. We recognize that the homocysteine problems are genetically linked through various polymorphisms like the MTHFR or methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase polymorphism that about 20% of the population or 1 in 5 people have that makes their folate connection more strong than the average individual or the wild genotype. And that these particular genotypes then have increasing risk to homocysteine-related dysfunctions. And we recognize that they also have increasing damage to their DNA. This is a marvelous paper recently published in the Journal of Nutrition, volume 135, page 389 in 2005, showing those people with the MTHFR CT polymorphisms have increasing relative risk to DNA damage, mutations, and potential carcinogenesis, which then leads to polymorphisms of MTHFR and lymphoblastic leukemia, and we talked about this a number of years ago, but it continues to grow in its understanding recently in BMC Medical Genetics, Volume 6, page 23, is a review paper on how polymorphisms of MTHFR in pregnant women lead to increasing incidence of pediatric lymphoblastic leukemia. So you can see that what we're really starting to witness is the transition of medicine from kind of silos of individual specialty to general themes surrounding mechanism, in which by understanding that we can better discuss then the relationship of genotypes to environments to produce specific outcomes. This leads to the personalized medicine concept that Dr. Perlmutter was talking about, and it was the whole focus of the 12th International Symposium on Functional Medicine with regard to immune imbalances. This theme will be continued throughout the year, and we look forward to sharing how we're going to travel into the 2006 symposium year, which will be focused on detoxification and the environment-gene interaction. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you next month.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.